Okay, so welcome, David. I'm looking forward to hearing this interview that we're doing here at Christie Walk, where I live, on Always Was, Always Will Be Ghana Land. Let's start with you explaining what you wanted to talk about today.
Well, I think we should take our initial impetus from the current situation. 25,000 Palestinian casualties and counting as of when we speak today. And this particular episode can be said for certain purposes to have begun on October the 7th. And presented itself as a complete surprise in the 24-hour news cycle. But, in fact, if you look at it in a historical cycle, the siege of Gaza has gone on for 16 years. Now, people don't just sit inside a besieged city and take it. They throw things back, so you get missile attacks and counter-attacks, actually. And you also get what the French call sorting, which has been translated in Gaelic language as sorting. And that is essentially an outing whereby the defenders issue forth from behind the protection of the walls of the city and go out and mix it with their assailants. October 7 was definitely a sorting. And that's a perception and an understanding that occurs to you if you've got some military history under your belt or some history of the Middle East, going back to ancient times or even only a couple of hundred years. But the thing is, when you have a historical perspective, you don't have the ignorance that comes with the 24-hour news cycle, and you don't have the despair either, because you realise that these struggles are marathons, not sprints. And there's no doubt that the Israelis will succeed in raising Gaza. They've almost succeeded as it is. They've just got to finish the job off. They think that'll take them another couple of months or three. But that will not be the end of the story. The survivors will not sit idly by and let this crime go unpunished. And we shouldn't lapse into inactivity or despair either, because there's things we can do to besiege the besiegers. Namely, we need to make them pay politically and culturally, and take a toll on them as a pariah state. Because this is what the Israelis are doing is outside all the laws of international law and all the laws of war itself. Even in the context of total violence, there's things that are regarded as being beyond the pale, as being atrocities. And the slaughter of a civilian population is one of those things outside the laws of war. It's all right for the armies to try and destroy each other by killing and bombardment, but taking out civilians is not regarded as part of war proper.
How does making them pay resolve anything?
Well,
No,
it doesn't have to be like that. Your objective can be peace. But you'll have to make the aggressor stop to get peace. And that will mean punishing his aggressive impetus, making it, enfeebling it, undermining it, overpowering it.
So when you say Israel, do you mean the government?
I mean the state of Israel.
The state of Israel, not the people.
Well, the people of Israel have, by a majority, signed on for this Zionist project. There are dissidents in Israel, and they don't approve of what's happening, but they are their efficacy is limited by their circumstances. It's a surveillance state. It's a militaristic state, and it's very. It's got great depth in its military-industrial complex. They make weapons and export expertise and hardware to the world. And they, one of the selling points is that it's battle-tested. After all, the siege of Gaza, the 16-year siege, there have been 5 major bombardments and incursions in all this time. And this is the 6th.
Is it the biggest?
It is the biggest, yes. But we don't need to go back to Hammurabi and some eye for an eye understanding of things, because that's not the point. The point is to win, not to match atrocities.
As a historian, you totally understand that history repeats itself. And yes, so from a historical perspective, on this, how would you predict that things will change?
Right, well, history repeats itself somewhat to a certain extent. It's not a literal cycle one, cycle two, and they're both on the same template. One historical philosopher thought that it went in sort of spirals, that there were returns to old developments, but integrated with new developments. And that's just a figure of speech, really. But in some sense, there's a point in that. How do we see new developments coming in which are optimistic? That was your question. Well, there are, for example, I can't go into this in too much detail at the moment because it's all on the drawing board, but we know that Australia is directly involved in the siege of Gaza, in the razing of Gaza. There are a number of firms in Australia that manufacture parts which are part of the worldwide supply chain, which keeps the F-35s, which are involved in the bombing of Gaza, flying. It's a very complex machine, and not all the parts work all the time. So when a part malfunctions, the plane may be unable to fly. Well, the response to that, the solution to that, is to whip in another part straight away and see that the supply is kept up. We're involved in that. It's a high volume, not a high volume, a high value chain. It's worth quite a lot of money. And it involves making things, you know, spare parts. And we can intervene in that by drawing public attention to it, by calling for the trade to be suspended while a war crime is going on, for example. Now, there's a bit of footwork that needs to be done in terms of making that effort effective, and I hope in a future podcast we might go into that campaign. But at the moment, it's a bit of a thought cloud, but we are collecting information. So that's something that can be done very specifically to intervene in the killing going on now. But there's other things. Anything that degrades the soft power or the political influence of Israel, whether it's by a letter or an email or a phone call to a politician or a visit to a politician, a letter to the editor, or involvement in some cultural circle or other that influences public opinion. All these things. It's really, people are creative, and it is up to each individual and within the compass of each individual to work out creatively what they can sustain, what they can do, and not exhaust themselves. Mm. So we can't really tell people what to do. We can just say don't lose hope and indicate some opportunities.
With our alliance with the US and the UK, it's going to be difficult.
Well, that makes you wonder about the worth of the alliance. The Americans don't seem to take very kindly to us giving them any friendly advice. Our government seems afraid of its own shadow and is trying to put daylight between its own policy and the policy of the Americans and the Israelis. But it's not affecting anything very much.
No.
So there's a bigger question which will emerge, and that is the question of the alliance.
Yes.
And there's active minorities who are prepared to say that the alliance is no good for us, one of whom was the late Malcolm Fraser, who wrote a book called Dangerous Allies. Mm. I don't see that the alliance will ever do anything else than involve us in its wars. Now, I don't think they're in the Australian national interest. So we've got to think of a diplomatic and military stance that can suit our interests and not involve us in those imperial and colonial wars.
But we're really not big enough.
No, we're big enough. We're a middling power. We've got to expect blowback.
Yeah.
If we even move an inch in that direction, the Americans will intervene. But if we're prepared for that, we may get away with it. We have to try anyway, because all that's going to happen is all of these wars could link up. All of America's antagonisms could link up. So the raising of Gaza could regionalise in the Middle East. It could extend to Iran. Iran is on the border with Afghanistan, which is on the border with India, which is on the border with China. Now, India seems to be playing footsie with everybody, the Americans and those on its borders. The Americans are antagonistic to China and to Russia. Well, that's all of Asia. And some of the American military intellectuals are mad enough to think they could take everybody on all at once. Probably they'll be forced to try and do it piecemeal, and in a way that's what's happening here, except the tail that wags the dog is conducting its own policy and it's not letting the Americans control it.
And meanwhile our nearest neighbours are just sitting back watching.
Well, I wonder how inactive they've been. You know, this is not going to make them look kindly on the American alliance.
No.
On, as I call it, the empire.
Yeah.
Because the Americans deny that, saying we don't directly rule. Well, the Athenian Empire didn't directly rule either. It was a matter of bases and alliances.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what the American Empire is.
So it's very complex, isn't it?
Well, in a way, the logic of it's quite straightforward. Mm. It's the detail where the complexity comes in. As a historian, you're dealing with logic and detail all the time, and you go into the detail to test the logic, to see whether the logic answers as it should to the detail. But So you have to address yourself to complexity. But at the same time, when you understand it, it's more straightforward. It's more logical and simple. Not simplistic.
With your knowledge as a historian, I really like the title you've given it.
Hmm.
And is that true in most occasions?
Besieged? Besieging the besiegers.
Yes.
Well, if you look at it just narrowly in terms of military history, this is the Romans used to practice something sometimes called circumvallation. Circumcircle, vallation, war, wall.
So and what the wall goes round and round?
Around the besiegers. Mm-hmm. And then you're besieging them. And I think our way of besieging them is not going to be military. I think it's going to be, it may have military aspects, but it's going to be essentially political and cultural. So we will be exerting influence to undermine the Israeli siege, the raising of Gaza, and the Zionist consequences that the Israelis will be attempting to realise. Because even the raising of Gaza will not end this struggle. The Palestinians practice Samud, which is to say resilience. They hang in there. Even when they're at a disadvantage, they don't surrender. It's a feature of the national character and culture. It has to be. So I don't think we need to despair. And indeed, I think despair is basically a first world luxury. There are things we can do in our own sphere of life, and we must do those things. We can get together collectively and do other things, things of a greater order perhaps, of a greater significance, but there's nothing that's useless.
Well, that's very interesting, and I also agree that despair is the first world.
Yes,
yes.
Well, there was an Italian political philosopher I often resort to when I'm trying to explain things like Simone, and he got from a French novelist a slogan which he applied to Italian culture and politics, which was pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. So see things for as black as they are, and get up in the morning and do something about it. You've got to be optimistic in that sense. You've got to be pessimistic in the sense that things are not good. The situation's not good. Mm. It's never ideal. Mm. You know, there's the famous Irish joke about the guy who pulled up in a Maserati and he asked the way to Dublin, and Paddy, who had been forking potatoes in the field, leant on his fork and said, if I were going to Dublin, I wouldn't start from here. And as Wittgenstein, the great linguistic philosopher, said, we're born into life, so we start in the middle. The situation's never ideal, but you have to muck in and get on with it.
With what we've got.
With what we've got. Mm-hmm. With what faces us.
Is that a good place to end it?
Yes.